Welcome back to the Deep Dive, where we plunge into complex topics and try to extract the knowledge you need, bypassing the noise and the jargon.
Hello.
Today, we are tackling one of the most persistent and frankly confusing puzzles in modern economics. We're calling it the UK energy paradox.
It really is a paradox. It's a contradiction that affects every single person listening right now. You know, regardless of their politics or their background,
right?
You look at your electricity bill, you see the soaring costs, and yet at the same time, you're hearing all these success stories.
That's the setup, exactly. I mean, the UK has achieved this monumental, world-class environmental victory.
It really has.
They've pulled off one of the fastest decarbonization programs on the entire planet. They phased out coal completely. The last plant shut down just last year.
And at the same time, they've become a global leader in offshore wind. The cost, the LCOE for new projects has just plummeted.
It's down something like 70% since 2014. It's shocking. So if you just look at the headlines, you'd think the UK should have access to the cheapest, cleanest power in the world.
That's the narrative, yes. That green power is, you know, technologically it's deflationary.
But, and this is the massive disconnect. Hmm. Despite having all this cheap, abundant green power flowing into the system, UK electricity prices are still stubbornly high.
Often among the highest in Europe.
Exactly. It feels like you've bought a brand new, super efficient electric car, but you're still paying the price for petrol at the pump. It just doesn't add up.
So our mission today is pretty critical. We need to move beyond that one, often misleading metric, the LCOE.
Right, the levelized cost of electricity.
Because that only tells you the cost of generating a single unit of power. What we're going to do is analyze the total system cost of electricity in the UK. We need to dissect, really, three core failures. Why the financial market is obsolete, how the physics of a modern grid creates enormous hidden costs, and why the infrastructure itself is failing, destroying the value of that cheap wind.
Okay, let's unpack this. First, I think we need to set the scene. The last decade and a half, say from 2010 to 2025, has just been a story of radical, rapid transformation. A physical revolution in how the UK gets its power.
It truly has. I mean, if you were to look at the UK grid back in 2010, coal was providing roughly 30% of the electricity.
A huge chunk.
A huge chunk. By 2024, that number was zero, gone.
Wow.
And at the same time, wind and solar went from being an almost negligible source, maybe 3% of the mix, to providing nearly 37%. That pace of change is it's pretty much unprecedented anywhere in the world.
So the green transition is real. It's staggering in its speed. But through this entire period, one fuel source has remained the consistent critical backbone.
Natural gas.
Natural gas.
Gas generation has fluctuated, of course, but it's consistently provided between 30 and, say, 46% of the UK's power. And this enduring reliance on gas is the absolute key to understanding the journey of consumer costs.
Which you can really split into two distinct chapters, can't you?
You can. Chapter one is, let's say, 2010 to 2020. This was the quiet rise.
Okay.
During this time, the wholesale price that the price generators got paid was actually pretty stable. It sat in the 40 to 50 pounds per megawatt hour range.
But our bills kept going up.
Your bills kept rising steadily. And that rise was down to what were called policy costs.
Right.
These were levies added directly onto consumer bills to fund the early, necessary, but very expensive subsidies for renewable schemes. Things like the renewables obligation and the early feed-in tariffs.
But we were basically paying a premium to bootstrap the low-carbon future.
You were. And then chapter two, from 2021 to now, just completely ripped up the rule book.
Yeah, the gas crisis. The global gas crisis.
Yeah.
Geopolitical instability, post-pandemic demand spikes. It was the ultimate stress test for the UK system. We saw wholesale prices peak well over £500 per megawatt hour in 2022.
Just an unbelievable figure.
And it wasn't just a blip. It proved definitively that the domestic price of electricity remains structurally tied, welded, to the international price of gas.
Regardless of how much zero-cost wind power you have on the system.
Exactly. Which brings us directly to the foundational flaw in the market's design.
Let's get into that. The archaic bidding system. Why gas still sets the price.
Mm.
So when we look at the total system cost, the most immediate driver of these high prices isn't the turbine itself. It's the market mechanism that decides what everyone gets paid. We're talking about marginal pricing.
We are. This is the system, also known as pay as clear, that the UK inherited from the privatization era. It was designed for a grid run on predictable, old-school thermal power stations. Okay, so it works on something called the merit order.
Yeah.
Can you break that down for us? Because This one mechanism seems to determine almost everything we pay.
It really does. Think of it like this. Imagine you're trying to fill a massive stadium for a huge event, and you have to use every single seat.
Okay.
The system operator, NISO, lines up all the available power generators from the cheapest to the most expensive. That's the merit order.
And who's the cheapest?
Well, the generators with the lowest fuel costs. So wind and solar with zero fuel costs, they bid at or near zero. They are the cheapest seats, and they get accepted first.
Right.
Then you get nuclear, which is baseload, and then finally the flexible fossil fuel plants. NISO just moves up that stack, accepting bids until they meet the exact demand for that moment.
And here's where the sting in the tail is, right? The pay is clear part.
This is the economic kicker. The price that is paid to all the successful generators.
All of them.
All of them. From the cheapest offshore wind farm to the expensive fossil fuel plant. That price is set not by their own bid, but by the bid of the last most expensive generator that was needed to satisfy demand.
So hold on. You're telling me this massive billion-pound, zero-cost wind farm gets paid the same high price as the last most expensive gas plant that fired up for just 5 minutes?
That is the definition of a marginal pricing system. It sounds completely counterintuitive, I know.
It sounds fundamentally unfair.
It's designed to ensure that the most expensive generator required is always willing to turn on to guarantee security of supply. And critically, in the UK system, that last marginal unit is almost always gas.
Because gas plants are flexible, they can ramp up and down quickly, and they have significant fuel costs to cover.
Precisely. They're the flexible balancing act. They have to buy fuel, and crucially, they also have to buy carbon permits under the UK Emissions Trading Scheme, the UK ETS.
Which makes them the marginal unit the vast majority of the time.
The vast majority. When you look at the data, it's just overwhelming. Studies consistently show that gas sets the wholesale price in the UK somewhere between 85 and 98% of the time.
I'll let that sink in. 98%.
It means that even on a sunny, windy day, when maybe 60% of the grid power is coming from zero-cost renewables, the price you pay is determined by the cost of that last little slice of gas generation needed to meet demand.
So if these zero marginal cost generators are getting this high gas set price, what's the economic term for that huge profit margin they're making?
Economists call them inframarginal rents.
Inframarginal rents.
In plain English, they're windfall profits. Because their operating costs are near zero, but they're getting paid the high gas price, they capture a massive unearned profit margin.
And this is the structural mechanism that funnels all that volatility from global commodity markets. The price of LNG from Qatar, Norwegian pipeline gas, directly onto our bills.
Correct. The market architecture effectively socializes the cost of gas across the entire power supply. If the gas price spikes, the consumer pays more, not just for the gas that was used, but for all the electricity generated, even the cheap stuff.
Okay, let's drill down into a UK-specific problem here. Why is the UK's marginal price often structurally higher than its neighbors, even when the global price of gas is the same?
That is the carbon price support, or the CPS. This was a hugely important and, in many ways, very successful unilateral policy intervention by the UK government.
An extra tax.
It's an additional domestic top-up tax on carbon emissions from power generation layered on top of the main UK ETS.
And the goal was simple. Kill coal.
And it works spectacularly. The CPS made it so expensive to generate with coal that it was forced right out of the merit order. But that success had a direct, measurable consequence for the marginal pricing mechanism.
It just raised the marginal cost of gas instead.
Exactly. Because gas is now the dominant price setter, the CPS acts as this continuous domestic multiplier. It slaps a hefty fee onto the marginal cost of the gas plants.
The implication for us as consumers is profound, then.
It is. It creates a high price floor for electricity in the UK. Even if the international price of gas drops, the UK wholesale price will always be consistently higher because of this domestic policy.
Yeah.
It's a guaranteed structural premium built into the UK price every single day.
Now, when people hear about this, the immediate reaction is, well, let's just switch the system. The common proposal is to move to pay as bid.
Mm-hmm.
The thinking seems simple. If wind is forced to bid its true cost, which is zero, it gets paid zero, and the consumer benefits. Is that not the obvious answer?
It sounds like an elegant solution, doesn't it? But sadly, market economists view it as a false panacea. It addresses the symptom, but not the underlying economic reality.
Why wouldn't solve the problem?
Because generators are rational commercial actors. They want to maximize their revenue. In a pay-as-bid system, a wind farm operator knows the market needs their power, and they know the system will likely clear around the price of the last required unit, which is gas.
So they wouldn't bid zero, even if their cost is zero?
Of course not. They'd engage in what's called shadow pricing.
Shadow pricing.
Think of it like this. If you have a perfect apple that cost you nothing to pick, but you know everyone else is selling apples for a pound, you're not going to sell yours for a penny just because that's your cost.
You'd sell it for 99 pence?
You'd bid 99 pence. The wind farm operator, knowing the gas price will probably be 100 pounds, will bid 98 pounds to make sure they're selected, but still capture maximum revenue.
So the cost of that last required megawatt hour still defines the scarcity value for the whole market.
That is the critical point. The fundamental scarcity value of the commodity, the fact that the system absolutely needs that most expensive unit to keep the lights on, will always define the price point, whether you call it pay as clear or pay as bid. You might change the name of the system, but you don't break the economic link.
Okay, so the marginal pricing system is the financial failure. Let's pivot now from the market structure to the brutal reality of physics. We need to talk about these escalating hidden costs of system integration, which you never see in those glossy, low LCOE figures for wind.
Right. We're moving now from the cost per unit of power to the true system costs. And running a grid that's heavily reliant on variable renewable energy, or VRE.
Wind and solar.
Wind and solar, yes. It's fundamentally different and fundamentally more expensive than running the old thermal-dominated grid.
What is the single biggest physical difference that makes the modern grid so much more costly to manage?
Inertia.
Inertia.
When the grid was dominated by these massive, heavy, rotating thermal power plants, coal, nuclear, those spinning turbines provided natural kinetic energy. They were like giant gyroscopes stabilizing the system frequency.
Like a natural shock absorber.
Exactly. If demand suddenly spiked or a generator tripped off the system, that physical inertia resisted the change, giving the operator maybe 5 or 10 seconds to react.
Okay, but renewables don't do that.
No. Wind turbines and solar farms, they're connected to the grid via sophisticated power electronics. They don't provide that same physical inertia. So as the share of VRE rises, the grid gets lighter, more volatile, and frequency deviations happen much faster.
So the system operator has to actively buy services to keep it stable.
They do. NISO has to actively procure and pay for synthetic inertia and extremely fast response services just to keep the lights on.
And this need to actively buy stability, instead of getting it for free from the physics of the old plants, has led to an absolute explosion in costs. Let's look at the numbers.
The numbers are staggering, and they represent a massive hidden cost to you, the consumer. In 2015, the net cost for balancing the system was around 506 million pounds.
Okay.
Just 5 years later, in 2020, that cost had surged to 1.3 billion pounds.
That's a 157% increase in 5 years.
And the future projections are even scarier.
What are they?
If the system continues on its current path, balancing costs are projected to peak at nearly 8 billion pounds by 2030.
8 billion. From half a billion to 8 billion pounds in 15 years.
That incredible increase is the cost of managing the instability that VRE introduces.
And the listener pays for every single penny of that through the BSUOS charges on their bill.
Yeah.
The balancing services use of system charge. It's basically the mandatory insurance policy for grid volatility.
That's a perfect way to put it. And a huge part of that cost is something called backfilling.
Let's define backfilling.
Backfilling is the urgent need to replace lost power when your primary source just disappears. Imagine a huge offshore wind farm suddenly sees the wind drop off, or a big weather front covers multiple solar farms, what the Germans call a Dunkelflaute.
A dark lull.
A dark, calm period. NISO gets a warning and has to call upon dispatchable capacity that can start instantly to fill that gap.
And because they're calling on this capacity at short notice, when the system is desperate, they have to pay what you call the flexibility premium.
They do. Since coal is gone, this falls almost entirely on fast-starting gas peaker plants or large battery systems. And because these assets are being used to manage sudden scarcity, they bid into the balancing mechanism at extremely high prices.
How high are we talking?
Significantly higher. While the standard wholesale market might be clearing at, say, 70 pounds a megawatt hour, a gas peaker plant needed to stabilize the system in the next 5 minutes might bid 200, 300, even 400 pounds per megawatt hour. or more.
But selling desperation.
They are. They're capitalizing on the scarcity value they provide in that exact moment.
So the more the system relies on these intermittent sources, the more expensive this volatile insurance policy becomes, and that gets baked directly into our costs.
Absolutely. And this whole analysis really forces us to confront the inadequacy of the standard metric we all use to judge renewables, the levelized cost of electricity, LCOE.
The LCOE is everywhere. It's the number everyone quotes when they say wind is cheap. What's the fundamental flaw with it?
The flaw is that LCOE treats electricity as if it's a homogeneous product, like flour or water. It assumes a megawatt hour generated at 3 in the morning when the system is oversupplied and the price might even be negative is identical in value to a megawatt hour generated at 6 p.m. on a cold, still winter day when the system is straining and the price is 400 pounds.
It completely ignores the value of when and where that electricity is produced.
Exactly. So we need a better metric. We need to introduce the listener to the value-adjusted LCOE, or VALCO.
VALCO, okay.
VALCO forces us to factor in the true systemic cost and value of that power. It incorporates three crucial adjustments that LCOE just ignores.
Let's take them one by one. First is energy value.
The energy value accounts for what's called the cannibalization effect.
Okay.
This happens when you flood the market with a low-cost source, like wind. The more wind you add, the more often the market is oversupplied during windy periods. This drives the wholesale price down during those specific hours.
So the price drops precisely when you're generating the most power, which cannibalizes your own revenue.
Exactly. So while the power is cheap, its overall value to the system is actually decreasing as its penetration increases.
Okay, what's the second adjustment?
The capacity value. This asks a simple question. What does this megawatt hour contribute to system adequacy? Does it reduce the chance of a blackout?
Right.
A megawatt hour from a predictable, firm source like nuclear or gas contributes nearly 100% capacity value. But a megawatt hour from an offshore wind farm, which is subject to the weather, contributes only a tiny fraction to system adequacy because you can't guarantee it'll be there when you need it most.
And the third factor, flexibility value. That ties directly back to those massive balancing charges we just talked about.
It does. Flexibility value measures the ability of a generator to ramp up or down instantly to balance the grid. Gas and batteries have high flexibility value. Wind and solar have low inherent flexibility value. When you factor all three of these in energy, capacity, and flexibility, the true dispatchable cost of renewables rises dramatically.
Which brings us to the storage question. To make wind truly reliable, to make it firm, you need massive storage. What's the economic reality of that?
The reality is that storage is still cost prohibitive for long durations. Batteries are fantastic for short-term balancing, maybe up to 4 hours, but they cannot cover a multi-day winter dunkel float.
And the long-duration solution we often hear about is green hydrogen.
Green hydrogen is a key technological hope, yes, but the economics today are really challenging because of the system's inherent inefficiency.
Inefficiency.
You use cheap electricity from wind to create hydrogen, which involves energy loss. You store the hydrogen, which requires massive infrastructure, and then you turn it back into electricity when the wind isn't blowing, which involves another round of energy loss.
You're paying an inefficiency penalty at every single step.
Exactly. And because of that round-trip inefficiency and the capital costs, analyses suggest the effective cost of that firm, dispatchable wind is pushed well over 150 pounds per megawatt hour.
150 pounds. That figure, ironically, puts it potentially higher than the guaranteed price for new nuclear power.
It does. It proves that while the marginal megawatt hour of wind is cheap, the firm, dispatchable megawatt hour of wind plus storage is still structurally very expensive.
So if marginal pricing is the financial failure, and intermittency is the physics failure, then grid constraint is the pure infrastructure failure. This is where the UK just throws away billions in economic benefits every single year.
This is a textbook logistics problem. It's so simple, it's almost infuriating.
The UK built its enormous wind generation capacity where the wind blows strongest.
In the North Sea, off the coast of Scotland.
But the bulk of electricity demand is firmly concentrated in the highly populated South.
London, the Southeast, the industrial centers.
Yeah.
And the transmission network, the grid, designed for a different era, simply cannot cope with the volume of power trying to travel that huge distance south.
We're talking about a specific bottleneck, aren't we? The B6 boundary.
Yes, the B6 boundary acts as this narrow pipe connecting Scotland's generation to England's demand. On a windy day, the cables just hit their thermal limits. They can't take any more power.
And when that happens, NISO is forced to intervene, leading to what our sources call the double penalty of constraint payments. This is the clearest example of waste in the entire system.
It's institutionalized inefficiency. When the grid gets bottlenecked, NISO has to do two things immediately, and the consumer pays for both. First, they pay the Scottish wind farms to stop generating.
They pay them to turn off.
Yes, compensating them for the lost revenue they would have earned. That's the curtailment payment.
And second, because the lights still need to stay on in London, they have to pay someone else to fire up instantly to replace the power that was just wasted.
Which means they pay expensive gas power stations in the south to start generating power that should have been supplied for free by the wind. So you are paying a clean generator not to generate, and then paying an expensive carbon-emitting generator to generate in its place.
The scale of this waste is just immense. The volume of green energy that was literally thrown away rose by 91% in 2024 to a colossal 8.3 terawatt hours.
8.3 terawatt hours? That's enough energy to power millions of homes for a year. Just loss.
And the financial cost of this. The direct constraint payments alone were over £393 million in that year.
And that's just the payment not to generate. The replacement cost adds significantly more.
Let's use a concrete example to make this unforgettable. The Seagreen Wind Farm. It's a massive flagship project, but it perfectly shows how these bottlenecks just destroy the economic benefits of cheap power.
The numbers for Seagreen are genuinely shocking. In one recent period, the farm generated electricity for which it received £104 million in revenue.
That's the value of the power it delivered.
Correct. But because the grid couldn't handle that power, NESO was forced to pay Seagreen nearly double that amount to not run.
Wait, say that again?
They received a staggering £198 million in constraint payments for energy they did not generate.
Unbelievable. The farm earned almost twice as much money for shutting down as it did for producing electricity. That figure. That's a punch in the gut when you look at your own bill.
It's the deep irony. The system operator is forced to destroy value to maintain physical stability. When researchers added all those costs up, the payment for generation, the payment for curtailment, they calculated the true effective cost to the consumer for every actual megawatt hour that Seagreen delivered.
And that cost was?
Approximately £270 per megawatt hour.
£270. When the official contract for difference strike price that the developer signed up for was only around £55.
Yes. The physical infrastructure failure inflated the effective cost of that cheap wind by nearly 500%. This is the clearest possible evidence that just building more green capacity does not automatically lower bills if the grid isn't expanded in lockstep.
Right. So we've covered the financial flaw and the infrastructure flaw. The third pillar of this high price paradox is the cost of securing firm, low-carbon baseload power nuclear, and the massive price tag the UK is paying for that reliability.
Nuclear is essential. It's firm, it's low-carbon, it's dispatchable. But the main modern example, Hinkley Point C, has become this case study in cost explosion.
We've seen the price projections for it just soar.
The inflation is staggering. The initial estimate for Hinkley was around £18 billion. As of early 2024, the projected cost has ballooned up to £46 billion in current money.
And the start date keeps getting pushed back.
Repeatedly. It's now slated for 2029 to 2031, if everything goes well from here.
Hinkley operates under a contract for difference, a CFD, which guarantees a price. What is the effective price we are now guaranteed to pay for Hinkley's power?
Well, the original strike price of £92.50, agreed way back in 2012, is indexed to inflation. That means by 2025, the effective strike price is approximately £128 per megawatt hour.
That is a very high price compared to the wholesale market today, and certainly far higher than recent wind auctions.
It is. The defense of it is that this price acts as a hedge for consumers against future catastrophic gas price spikes. It locks in a maximum cost for decades. But viewed today, yes, it represents a substantial cost premium.
Now, a key insight from the analysis is that this high cost isn't just about general inflation or project management. It reflects a unique UK element. The regulatory environment, which imposes what's called the sovereign regulatory premium.
This is a crucial nuance that's often missed. The UK's Office for Nuclear Regulation, the ONR, runs one of the world's most rigorous regulatory regimes. It's non-prescriptive, it's outcome-based, which demands that the developer, EDF, provide this massive bespoke burden of proof for every single safety aspect.
And that regulatory burden translated directly into physical, expensive design changes.
It did. The standard reactor being used is the European Pressurized Reactor, the EPR, but EDF was required to implement over 7,000 design changes to that standard model just to satisfy unique British safety requirements.
7,000 changes. That's not a tweak, that's a complete re-engineering project.
It is. These mandated changes meant that Hinkley physically required 35% more steel and 25% more concrete than comparable plants built elsewhere in Europe. It turned Hinkley from what should have been an nth-of-a-kind project into a bespoke, expensive, first-of-a-kind engineering challenge.
Can you give us a specific example that really illustrates this concept of regulatory gold plating driving up costs?
Absolutely. Look at the mandate for the acoustic fish deterrent system in the cooling water intakes.
The what?
The acoustic fish deterrent. Environmental regulators insisted on this immensely complex system, which involves high-powered acoustic emitters to scare fish away from the pipes, despite EDF providing extensive evidence that the actual environmental risk was negligible compared to the cost.
So a policy choice prioritizing an infinitesimal risk becomes a multi-million pound engineering headache that pushes back the schedule and raises the price for all of us.
It's a perfect microcosm of how policy ambition, when it's translated into regulatory complexity, imposes a very high sovereign tax on major infrastructure projects in the UK.
Now, recognizing that the Hinkley model transferred all the risk to the developer, which led to that high cost, the government has moved to a new financial model for the next big project, Sizewell C, the Regulated Asset Base, or RA model.
The RB model is designed specifically to lower the cost of capital, the cost of borrowing money, by shifting some of that construction risk away from the private developer.
Oh.
Under RB, consumers contribute a small levy on their energy bills during the construction phase of the plant.
So we start paying before a single electron is generated. That sounds like a tough sell.
It is a controversial transfer of risk, yes. But in return, that guaranteed revenue stream significantly de-risks the project for investors. The developer's cost of capital, the interest rate they pay, drops dramatically from maybe 9% under the old model to a much lower 4 to 6% under RB.
And what are the predicted savings in the long run?
The modeling suggests the RAB model could save consumers a colossal £30 billion over the project's lifetime compared to the Hinkley structure.
But the caveat is huge.
The caveat is that risk transfer. The consumer becomes the investor. If Sizewell C suffers delays or cost overruns, it's the consumer, via that levy, who bears that cost directly and immediately on their bills.
Okay, so we've established the three drivers of high prices. The government recognizes the market is basically broken, which led to the review of electricity market arrangements, or REMA.
REMA was conceived as the vehicle to address these flaws head-on, specifically the gas price linkage and those crazy constraint payments. They looked at two radical reforms.
Option one was zonal pricing or locational marginal pricing. If you look at that Seagreen example, this seems like the most rational fix.
In pure economic theory, zonal pricing is the most efficient solution. It would split the UK market into regional zones, Scotland, the North, the Southeast, for example, each with its own local price reflecting local supply and demand.
So Scotland, with its huge surplus of cheap wind, would have very low prices. And London, in the constrained South, would have higher prices.
Exactly. This creates a powerful market signal. It incentivizes generators to build closer to where power is needed, and it incentivizes energy-intensive industries to relocate near the cheap power. The analysis suggested it could save consumers around £30 billion over two decades.
So why did REMA largely reject it?
Politics. This is where politics and investment fear Trump economic efficiency. The government was terrified of creating a postcode lottery for consumer bills.
A massive political backlash.
A huge backlash. And developers warned that it introduced immense volume risk, uncertainty over local prices, which made investing billions in offshore wind in Scotland significantly less bankable.
So they chose political stability over radical economic efficiency.
That's the trade-off. They chose the path of least resistance for investment.
What about the second radical option? Market splitting, the idea of a green power pool.
This was designed to explicitly break the financial link between renewables and gas. You'd create two distinct pools. a variable power pool for wind and solar, priced at their true low long-run marginal cost.
And a firm power pool for dispatchable power like gas and nuclear, priced at the high short-run marginal cost.
Correct. The consumer would then buy a blended weighted basket of both. If 60% of power came from the cheap pool, the average consumer price would fall immediately and significantly.
Brigittis was deprioritized.
Yes, the complexity. Implementing a system like that requires enormous regulatory and technical overhaul. It risks fracturing market liquidity, making cross-border trading more difficult. The government, through REMA, ultimately opted for incremental changes rather than this kind of revolutionary fracture.
So, if radical market redesign is off the table, what's the ultimate action plan to unlock the cheap green power we've already built?
It boils down to brute force engineering, the big build. The consensus is that the physical infrastructure lag, those crippling constraints, is the most immediate and costly problem that has to be solved no matter what.
Meaning a massive acceleration in building transmission lines.
Exactly. Building high-voltage pylons and subsea superhighways at a pace not seen since the post-war era. To finally get that abundant Scottish wind power south to the demand centers.
This will increase the network costs on our bills in the short term as we pay for all that new steel and copper.
It will. But in the long run, this investment is the only viable path to eliminating that core inefficiency. The £1 billion or more wasted every single year on those constraint payments.
It's the expensive but necessary precondition. The pragmatic choice after rejecting the more disruptive financial reforms.
It's the cost of physically overcoming the grid's limitations to finally capture the true low value of the UK's incredible offshore wind assets.
This has been a deeply informative look into the machinery of energy pricing. If we circle back to our original question, why are UK electricity prices so high despite having cheap green power? What is the final synthesis we can offer?
I think the UK is paying a double premium on its energy transition, and both are structural.
The first premium is the cost of the financial system's failure.
Yes. The marginal pricing system acts as a ratchet. It ensures the entire system cost is lifted up by the price of the most expensive fuel gas, made even more expensive by the UK's domestic carbon tax.
Even with 60% of our power coming from clean sources.
The cost of gas dictates the financial structure of the entire supply.
And the second premium is the cost of the physical system's failure.
That's the failure to invest in the grid itself. The UK is simultaneously paying these massive, escalating hidden system costs, the flexibility premium, the high balancing charges, the spiraling constraint payments, just to manage a volatile system that literally cannot handle the clean power it's already producing.
We're paying to build a future system while still paying for the costly inefficiencies of the old one.
Exactly. The low LCOE is real, but the true VALCOE, the cost of integrating that low-cost power into a reliable, functional grid, is currently astronomical, and the consumer is footing the bill for that entire integration gap.
Which leaves us with a final provocative thought for you to consider. The path to lower bills requires not just building more green generation, but fundamentally realigning the physical grid and the financial market. When REMA was presented with the radical cost-saving option of zonal pricing, which could have eliminated billions in waste, the UK government rejected it because of the political fear of creating a postcode lottery. So, if market efficiency is repeatedly blocked by political and social concerns about fairness and stability, is this regulatory premium, this cost of complexity and consensus, the true unavoidable price of the UK's unique and ambitious approach to achieving net zero? We'll leave you to consider that paradox as you look at your next energy bill.